I just don't know what to say, yeah. I'm reading this, looking at this, you know, having a lot of distraction. Of course, you know, helps really to firm our practice in the Buddha. Isn't it? I mean, the more distraction we have, the firmer becomes our Buddha. That's what we believe. I mean, if you just do 1 hour of meditation a day, you know, it is really good. I mean, once we start to get over 8 hours or 10 hours or 12 hours, and then 15 hours, and then 16 hours or 17 hours or 18 hours of practice a day, I mean, the Kilesas tell us clearly that is too much. I mean, we just cannot concentrate anymore. And because we are used to listen to the voice of the Kilesas, they tell us this is right, and then we believe that this is right, and they tell us this is wrong, and we believe this is wrong, you know. I mean, who else should we believe? We have nobody else to believe than the things that we believed in since we were born. I mean, we believed our parents a little bit until they forbid us this and forbid us that, and then they made us do this and they made us do that. And our belief and our respect for our parents dropped away, you know, bit by bit. Because we are constantly in line with our wishes, we are constantly in line with our wanting and not wanting. And so that's what, you know, that's why we believe, you know, having a lot of distraction, you know, helps our practice. I mean, if it gives us any clue and if it gives us any insight at all, a lot of distraction is the difference between distraction and practice. But if you don't have any distractions, I mean, our practice will just become firmer and firmer and firmer. But then we believe in, because we cannot compare it to the distractions. I mean, our practice is nothing. I mean, it's just a lot of work. It's just a lot of bothersome. It just doesn't lead us anywhere. I mean, we are constantly, you know, just believe this. You know, we are constantly fooled by the Kilesas. I mean, there's just no way that we know at the moment what is the Kilesas and what is Dhamma. And some people read, you know, this is Dhamma and that is not Dhamma. So then this is just another belief. I mean, they just read it and believe it and they interpret it, you know, and their interpretation of what they think is Dhamma, I mean, it has nothing to do with Dhamma. If they are good, you know, it comes close to Dhamma or points in the direction of Dhamma. But what has the text of the books or the scriptures or the letters of the book have to do with the practice? Nothing. I mean, it's just the reading. It's just an interpretation. I mean, it doesn't mean that the books are not helpful. They are helpful. And the more they are about practice, the more helpful they are. I mean, if somebody talks about his practice, like in the biography of Ajahn Mun, or in the Patipada, the practice of Thanatha Mahabodhi, you know, it is really encouraging. I mean, fighting one's tiredness by sitting on the top of a cliff. The moment one knows one nods off, you know, one falls and shatters to death. I mean, then all the tiredness is completely gone. Or going in a tiger-infested area. I mean, you don't go to sleep. I mean, you practice all day, all night long until the tiger moves away. And why do you think, you know, these bhikkhus of the forestman tradition are all crazy. I mean, they use these means, you know, to overcome the kilesas. They're obnoxious. I mean, obnoxious kilesas. They ruled us, or they constantly rule us. not only this life, but the last billions of lives. Who ruled us? Avijja. So do you think, you know, we can convince Avijja? No, I want this to be my last life, you know. Avijja, please go away, you know, I don't want you, I don't need you anymore. I mean, you think it will fudge? You think it will but? It will go away just by asking it to go away? Or just like, you know, just by doing 1 hour of practice? I mean, it just lasted our back. Look at how stupid he is. Even following the language. And once we start to read the books, and once we start to read the texts of the Lord Buddha, then we understand the Dhamma, and then we think we know the Dhamma. And when we know the Dhamma, we don't have to practice. I mean, it's still the realm of avijja. It still is the realm of avijja. We can read as many books, as inspiring as they might be. Day in, day out, it's much better to read than to read any other books. Certainly this is one positive effect, you know. Constantly considering oneself as Dhamma. But there's a danger, as the Lord Buddha said. I mean, the danger is, I mean, if you grab a snake by the head, you know, then that's okay. It's not dangerous. But he compared the Dhamma, you know, to a snake. If you grab it by the tail, I mean, it just turns its head and bites you, and you die. And that's what he considered, you know, learned Dhamma to be, a snake. If you do not grab it correctly. And what does it mean, you know, to grab it correctly?
Practicing.
That's right. To practice in accordance with the teaching. Not in accordance what we think it is. Not in accordance to what we believe it to be. And now when I get into the talk, you know, please close your eyes and center your attention on the heart to listen very carefully. I mean, just the last 2 or 3 months, being with some of you out there in the isolation. I mean, on a mountain where we are just alone. Some of us spend it in caves. Some of us, you know, in a sala that was made for the monks. I mean, there was nothing else than the wind and the sun. That's all what was there. There were no lay people coming and disturbing us. We hardly did see any lay person. We had our one meal a day in the morning, where we saw a few of the lay people, or where you saw a few of the lay people. Much less than I saw when I went on Tinder path, or when I went on my arms round. And then after we had our meal, we didn't engage into talking to the lay people. I mean, for you it is much more difficult, because you're not familiar with the language. We went up the hill, you know, and we started to practice. Be it sunny, be it rainy, be it windy. What we had to drink was water, mostly water. In the evening, in a coffee. That's it. There were no sweets, there was no chocolate, there was no this distraction and that distraction, and then, of course, you know, this is not an easy way. You just you just can't get out of the practice. I mean, all what you can do on this mountain is to practice. Otherwise you get bored very easily. But of course, you know, some people when they get bored very easily, they run down the hill, you know, and looking for their puppy. In the midday heat. And then in the midday heat, yeah. Normally they don't want to go up in the midday heat. Or they want to go down in the midday heat. But once they just think of their defilements, of their kilesas, of wanting, yeah. And just run in the middle of the day down, you know, to see their path. Little dog, they caught up. I mean, that is the kilesas governing us all the time. I mean, they don't give us a free minute. If we don't fight them with Buddha, or if we don't fight them with Panya, means with with wisdom. I mean, they don't let us a moment of free time. I mean, if we fight them with Buddha and we drop into samadhi, then we know, you know, the difference. Now it is without kilesa, constantly necking, constantly dragging on our skirt or on our trousers. I want this, I want this, I don't want this, I don't want this, I like this, I like this, I don't like this, I don't like this. Then we know the difference. But only if we can enter samadhi, then we know the difference. If we still cannot enter samadhi, the kilesas are constantly necking about this and necking about this. Not letting us do this and not letting do us that. And constantly complaining about why didn't I get enlightened. You know, I've been here already 3 weeks. I mean, that it has nothing to do. I mean, it is still a mild form of dukkhas. The moment we get into areas, they're really tiger infested, eh? Or we're really going to fight our tiredness. We see, you know, I'm getting too easily tired. Yeah? No, just let's sit at the top of a mountain. Let's sit at the top of a cliff. I mean, when I get tired and not off, you know, I just fall over and scatter to death. I mean, there's nobody willing to fight. There's nobody willing to nod off. I mean, you don't nod off. I mean, you sit all the time. And trying your best, you know, and in samadhi. Or you go in a cave, you know, and then a tiger comes visiting and stays at the cave. Like it happened to Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Kaur. I mean, he was tired, he wanted to sleep, you know. He just looked at the tiger who was in front of his cave, and so he didn't get up. I mean, he practiced the whole night through. I mean, he was scared. And in the morning still, the tiger didn't want to leave him. And he told him, you know, I mean, you know, now it's time, you know, the whole night you haven't taken your food, you know, it's time to go to take your food, you know, it will be, the sun will be out, you know, in no time. And the tiger growl really loud. I mean, as if he wasn't just interested in having food. He just was observing or watching Ajahn Kaur, you know, or Ajahn Chah, you know, to do his practice all night long. I mean, these are the perfect helpers for us to get into samadhi. Not only into upachara samadhi, but in apana samadhi. Or sitting on a cliff. Or going in a tiger infested area. I mean, where there are just tigers. I mean, you don't fall asleep. You're just so afraid, you know, you just drop into samadhi very easily. And that is the whole purpose. That was the whole reason why, I mean, all of the forest monks, and especially, you know, the monks that have turned into arahants, chose that way. I mean, there is no way. And in Thai you say, there's a saying, if you want the baby of a tiger, there is no way that you cannot go into a tiger cave. You have to go into the tiger cave to get the tiger baby. And do you think that the mother The tiger mother gives you your baby freely, without a fight. You really think that? You really think that you can convince a tiger mom that she gives away her tiger baby without fighting? And not only fighting, but fighting to her own death? And that is just a synonym for our spiritual path. Fighting against the tiger mom who keeps the tiger baby. And the tiger mom is nothing else than avijja. Until avijja is not completely destroyed, we cannot have the tiger baby. And that means our true form, Nibbana. I mean, the tiger mom is going to protect Nibbana all the time long. It won't let go of it. And we cannot enjoy it until we haven't fought, until we haven't fought avijja to the death. I mean, just ask yourself, how much are you going to willing to give in to this path of practice? You're coming all from the Western background. I mean, in the Western world, and especially in America, we have McDonald's. In McDonald's, you can order a hamburger, but I don't like the hamburger with onions, or I don't like the hamburger with mustard, or I don't like the hamburger with ketchup, or I don't like it at all with the bun. I mean, you order, and you are the king. Because in America, the customer is the king. I mean, whatever he orders, that's what he gets. And I'm sure that if you order a cheeseburger without cheese, I mean, they will sell it to you. I mean, they just sell it to you. They don't ask you, what's the purpose of it. They just sell it to you. And so is it probably, most probably, to my observation, it's the same thing with the spiritual life. Instead of calling it McDonald's, you call it Mac Nibbana. I mean, you just order your Nibbana without dukkha. Or you order Nibbana without a super, without doing investigation of greed and hate. Or you want your Nibbana with full pride installed. I mean, no scratch at your pride. Or no scratch at your ego. I mean, in the West, they sell it to you. I mean, there's no reason why they shouldn't. I mean, they all think Nibbana is Nibbana, you know. It doesn't matter. So they serve it to you. But I don't know, you know, what kind of real Nibbana is. You know, it is very different from the Nibbana that is here out in the Thai forest tradition. I mean, just look how they strangle themselves, how the monks strangle themselves, and how much they strive. Just going out alone in the dangerous places, full of dangerous animals, and trying to establish their Buddha, and trying to develop their wisdom. I mean, they did it on their own. And when we look back at the teachings of the Lord Buddha, you know, that's what he actually recommends. I mean, he doesn't recommend, you know, staying in a forest monastery, you know, being in a group of 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 people, or 200 people, or 500 people. I mean, he says, there are the open, there are the wilds, there is the forest. There are the caves, there are the hills. That's the place where you monks should go and develop your practice. You shouldn't go there in numbers or in groups. You should go there by yourself. Find a spot that suits your practice and then just develop your practice. Just being on your own. In the morning you go on arms round and get your food and that's it. And the rest of the day, and the night, you just go on with your practice. I mean, just think about it. Coming from the Western background, with all this comfort, and now with the spiritual comfort of Meknibbana, you know, being in a meditation center, doing a 10-day retreat. I mean, some people are up to it, you know. I do a month retreat, you know. And after this month retreat, I certainly get my diploma that I'm a Sri Mantra. I mean, these meditation centers, probably the more they cost, the more comfortable they are. I mean, what is comfort? Comforters can be translated as the neediness of the kilesas. I mean, when all the neediness of your type is satisfied, the kilesas won't come up. They won't show. I mean, the greed won't show up if you get three meals a day. And maybe the sweets are served, you know, in sugary tea or whatever, you know. Or herb drink, you know, if it's an organic, if it's more organic spiritual development center or whatever. I mean, they serve you whatever you want. Or you get, you know, like in McDonald's, you get whatever you ask for. Oh. I mean, just think about it. Ask yourself, is this the way how to overcome greed and hate? I mean, we just believe. Okay, now we are Buddhist. And a Buddhist should not have any hate. And a Buddhist should not have any greed. So we go into these comfortable locations. And of course, then greed and hate wouldn't show up. I mean, there's no need. We have all the things that we need. I mean, the greed and hate certainly is going to show up. Are in lonely places, in fearful places, in threatening places, in places where you don't get enough food, or where you get the food that you don't like. And just have water. You have no communication, no TV, no telephone, no books. All what you're confronted is with your little pity soul. And then you see the power of the kilesas. I mean, you just see. I mean, they just convince you of anything, that this place is not okay, you know. I mean, this place is just terrible. I mean, I don't have anything, you know. My practice just does not develop because I'm constantly fighting this greed and anger. And this greed and anger, you know, if I satisfy my greed and let out my anger, you know, this is much more profitable for my practice. I mean, that's what people say. And I'm really sick of, you know, going against it. I mean, let the people believe what they want to believe. I mean, I've been on the spiritual path. I've been into spiritual homelessness for the last 18 years. Years, not months. I've been a monk for nearly 14 years. And not anyway in a nice, comfortable monastery, but in a pretty harsh environment. In a place, you know, where in the heat or in the hot season, you know, when I sat 15 minutes, you know, I was drenched in sweat. And in the cold season, I was shivering. It was so cold that I even couldn't lie out. In the rainy season, my skin got moldy and itchy for 3 months. I mean, just now, think about it. Who of the Westerners? I mean, would be able to tolerate this. He thinks this is too much torment. I mean, I don't need to punish his body.
and he would eat. The moment he leaves, you know, all what I can say, that's the end of his practice. He won't get any further. But even then, in this environment, it's a little bit rough, and most of us, especially for the first years, I mean, we all have to think where we come from. When we come from America, I mean, we have to fight with bacteria we have never known of. I mean, we come from a completely disinfected environment. I mean, we use any kind of sprays to disinfect the household, the place where we are, the car where we stay. We disinfect everything and kill all the bacteria. In Europe it's a little bit better, but we still do use a lot of disinfectant. Now we come to a country, in Thailand, to a forest, to a jungle, where we are bombarded with these bacteria. I mean, it's hot, and you know, in the hot or in the heat, the bacteria just grow like mushrooms. So we will have some difficulties with our body. Learning, teaching, or training the body to cope with this kind of environment. So we will experience the truth of the Lord Buddha, that the body is born, that the body gets sick, and the body gets old, and the body will die. We are face to face with this truth. Just going, you know, from a disinfected country to a country like Southeast Asia, or in this case, Thailand. And the same thing is with our food. I mean, coming from America, all the food that we get is pre-processed for easy digestion. I mean, Europe doesn't differ too much from it, but we still have, or there are still types, you know, who use some organic food. Now we come into an environment, I mean, where the stomach has to work to get the nutrients out of the food. I mean, it has to learn how to digest, because the food that we get here is not pre-processed. I mean, it's as natural as it is gross. So it's a second thing that we have to adjust to. So any kind of food poisoning that comes from, any kind of stomach ache that comes from this food, it is quite natural, because our stomach and our body are just not used to this kind of environment. Because in the West we are so so eager to kill off all these bacteria. And then when we come here, you know, we're just bombarded by them all. I mean, they hardly give us any time to adjust the body to it. And then the heat makes it, you know, makes it also. The heat, or the extremely rain, or the extremely dampness of the rainy season. I mean, some of you haven't even experienced the rainy season. I mean, when everything becomes wet and nothing dries off. I mean, the skin, the same thing. Your skin just doesn't have the time to dry off. So it gets moldy, as just as any kind of cloth gets moldy. I mean, this is just a physical training. A physical training for an overdeveloped country, you know, for people from an overly civilized or overly developed country, you know, to come into a country or a climate like it is here in Thailand. Normally people from the West only visited in the pleasant months, you know, they are from November to the start of February, you know, where it is cool, or where it is cooler and where it's not so much afflicted by the heat and bacteria in the rain and so on. So they probably don't know it, because they haven't lived here for long enough. So you can ask yourself, I mean, do you want Magnibana or do you want the real thing? I mean, for Magnibbana, you don't have to stay. You really don't have to take this roughness. I mean, you just sit there in a nice environment, in a nice climate, upon a cliff, on your sitting cushion, you know, and get whatever you want. But just reflect about the number of arahants that have sprung up in the last 100 years here in Thailand. In the forest, in the midst of the forest. Of course, the Thais were used to this climate, so they used other things. They used the means of tigers, they used the means of dangerous places, of cliffs, of overhanging cliffs, of caves that are haunted, or the caves that are, have an owner, and nearly, like Ajahn nearly being killed by the owner of the cave because he thought, you know, it's his cave, you know, no monk should stay there. And the 5 monks before him all died of strange stomach problems. They just died. Ajahn Man survived because he fought with the spirit of a spiritual warrior. He was not giving in to death. Yeah, it's better to die, you know, as a spiritual warrior than to die, not to die as a wimp. I mean, where is this? Where is this mentality? Is there something? Huh? Do we have something of this hardwood that arahants are made of? Do we have this hardwood within our spirit? Or are we all of softwood? I mean, we just need a few termites, you know, and they eat everything up. They just leave the skin. And only the moment we touch the skin, we know, oh, it's empty. We touch the skin of a tree, you know, and then we know, oh, this is all eaten by termites. The moment we touch it, you know, it falls apart. Hardwood and the termites are the killers. Hardwood is something that the termites have a hard time to chew on. So they avoid it. And that is the kind of spirit that we need. I mean, I'm just sorry. I'm sorry to say. But there is no easy way out. There's just no easy way out. I mean, either we fight to the death, either we bring this lion mother or this tiger mother, we fight it to their death to get nibbana. We just have no other way. Or we die. If we die, you know, by fighting this avicca, I mean, we die a good death. If we die because we give up, and go back into the world of the kilesas, or this is much more comfortable, or this is much nicer, or this place is much better, or this person is not so rough, or this teacher, you know, he's much softer, you know. He says, yes, you're doing good work, yes, you're doing good work. He never scolds us. But I'm sorry, I'm just not that kind of person. I mean, I scold if I see the kilesas. When I see them popping up in you, you know, you get a heavy scold. Why? Because I have trained myself. The moment I saw the kilesas within myself, to fight them off, to scold them off, to bring them down, to tear them down. That's my way of the last 18 years. Years. I mean, years. Continuous years of practice. I mean, I didn't do it just for a month, you know, and then get off the hook. And the next year I did it another month. And then the next year I did it another month. I mean, it was continuous practice, 18 years long. Up till now. trying not to let the kilesas hook. Trying the moment I saw them within myself, and sometimes I didn't see them, so my teacher pointed them out to me. And the way he pointed it out, you know, it is not always nice. Just in the meaning, what the hell are you think you're doing? I mean, do you know yourself? That's the way of his admonishment, of his scope. It's not, oh dear little brother, you know, you have a black spot on your trousers. I mean, maybe you want to get rid of it. No, that's not the language he used. I mean, his language was the language of the tiger. I mean, if there is no tiger in the monastery, you know, then the teacher has to be the tiger. To scare the people to help to show off their kilesas. I mean, that's all the whole purpose. He doesn't want to destroy the lion baby, but he wants to destroy the lion mother. Or the tiger mother, whatever. The tiger mother is that bodhisattva. The tiger mother is that what holds the tiger baby, nibbana, really firmly in the grip. I mean, I told you before. Somebody wanted to visit his parents. He said, yes, you can go, but you don't need to come back. I mean, now you look at the monastery, you know, the monks just go anywhere they like. Now they go to visit their parents, now they go to visit their friends, now they go to visit this place or that place, India, or, you know, they go all over the place. I mean, they're just tourist monks. I mean, there are hardly any practicing monks left. So he kept it. Within his monastery, you know, he still kept it in line. He is the venerable teacher. The venerable meditation master. So if somebody felt sick, you know, and felt he was in need of some medicine, you said, oh, sure, you can go and see the doctor, but pack your things and never come back. I mean, just think of from your background, from your Western background, are you ready to submit to such a teacher who only knows to scoff, who only knows to admonish, who only stands in front of you when you did a mistake? There, what did you do? Raise yourself. What the hell are you doing right now? Constantly is in front of your kuti and looks, what are you doing? And if he catches you more sleeping than practicing, he kicks you. It's not a place for sleep. It's not a place for indulging into sleep. It's not a place for indulging into eating. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but from my experience with Westerners for the last 7 years, we just don't take this crap. I mean, we just leave. I mean, who the hell is he? How the hell he can scold me like this? I mean, I'm not a child. I'm a grown-up adult. I don't need to take this crap. That's what a Westerner normally thinks. I mean, believe it or not, in the terms of spiritual development, you're just little spiritual children. Still wearing your diamonds. And the diapers are full of shit. But because you think you are grown up, you take off the diapers and you throw it at your teacher. We all think we have grown up. We all think we have rights. I mean, that is not the way of spiritual practice. Spiritual practice is the practice of generosity, respect, gratitude. Grateful for the teaching, grateful for the scolding he gives, grateful that he points out a flaw in our practice, grateful that he points out the things that we still need to develop. Grateful for him that he shows us that there is still anger within us, or that there is still greed within us, putting his finger on him and having respect for him. Otherwise, our practice just might finish at that. Whatever level, however much we can take, that's what we can take, and then we leave. I mean, I don't mind, you know, if you can't take it anymore and leave. I said it to the people after seeing, you know, it is difficult for 3 weeks. Who followed me into the mountain. I mean, I don't mind if you leave. I know it is hard. It is very difficult for you. You're not accustomed to this kind of training. You're not accustomed to this kind of harsh and rough training. I mean, You're free to go back. You wanted to stay up? And then one of them exploded at me. And he got angry at me. This I don't like. That I don't like. I only want this. And that's why I came up with the idea of Meknibbana. I mean, either you take it all, or you just leave it. I mean, I can only give you all. I can give you the food for enlightenment, to make up your spiritual practice, to get to the end of dukkha. You can take it, or you can leave it. This is completely up to you. But throwing up anger at me, I mean, that is not really up. He is not the only person who did it. I mean, I've met quite a few people. And that's why I reflected a little bit about it. In the last 7 years, I met quite a few people. I mean, just by telling the truth. This is like this, this is like that. I make people angry. And they shout out their anger at me, throwing their stones at me. Or throwing their shit at me. I mean, I don't mind. I mean, we just have the saying in English. If you are sitting in a glass house, don't throw the stone. As long as we haven't gotten out of the shit of the kilesas, as long as we're still swimming or diving or are under in the mud of the kilesas or in the shit of the kilesas, I mean, it is very helpful to throw shit at a person who already has some ground under his feet, who already has a passage here when he walks long enough that within 7 lives he can reach Nibbana. I mean, he just needs to walk. We, who are spiritual children, still wearing our diapers. I mean, we still swim in the sea. The moment we take a hand and throw it, we will go under. And we have to suffer from and drink that shit. But we think, of course, we don't think it's shit. We think we are right and he is wrong. I mean, I just want to caution you. I mean, when you look at it, when you look at the spiritual development, the person, you know, who spiritually develops him, if he wants to reach Nibbana, and Nibbana is the top of the mountain. I mean, the higher he climbs up, the better his views, the better he sees, the better he sees, or the clearer he sees the path that leads up the mountain. I mean, people, and most of the people, and especially the people who criticize me, are all still staying down there at the foot of the hill, throwing up with a lot of effort. They are stones of anger. I mean, I don't even know if they reach me. If they reach me, they bounce off. And what kind of devastating effect? Now just think of that. The higher you throw the stone, the more devastating effect when it comes back down onto you. I mean, it just knocks you off. But people don't think. I mean, they think, you know, I know. I know it better. I've read it in the text of the Buddha. A bhikkhu should have right speech. What is right speech? Right speech is telling the truth. That is right speech. I mean, I don't hide anything. I tell the truth. I mean, if people don't want to hear the truth, please close your eyes, close your ears, and close your eyes, and don't listen to it. If you're insulted by the truth, I mean, I can't help you. Just close your ears and don't listen to it. But just don't get angry. I mean, you don't know where I am standing. The higher I am standing, the more devastating the effect is of criticizing me or throwing your anger at me. I mean, keep your control. This is the way of the Lord Buddha teaches. If you are angry, you control it. Before you let it out, you know, you stamp it or you drown. And the best way to drown it is to say and repeat Buddha, 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 until the anger is gone. I mean, letting it out, especially at your teacher, I mean, has a devastating effect. It can throw you completely off the path. I mean, ask yourself, and that is, I'm not only addressing you who are sitting here. I'm addressing all the people, you know, who came here or who write me and accuse me of this and accuse me of that. All the people when I went to Germany, I mean, they're especially too secret. I mean, I just gave a talk and the people got so angry at me. One was in Switzerland, and one was in, and two of them were in Munich. They got so pissed at what I was saying. I mean, I feel sorry for them. I mean, if I can't open my mouth and tell you the truth, this is helpful, this is Dhamma, or this is the Kilesas. I mean, who do you ask? Do you ask your own Kilesas what is Dhamma and what is Kilesas? Can you ask them? Do they give you the right answer? Just think about it. I mean, most of you are really standing in the foot of the hill. At the foot of the mountain, do you know how the view is from up there? I mean, that is just exactly the way that I trained myself. That's why it comes out right now. I mean, there were three occasions I remember within the last 14 years, there were three occasions where I thought, why did Kenneth Mahabho scold me in this way? Maybe he has misjudged me. And immediately the Dhamma came out like this. Who are you? Who the hell are you? You know, you're standing still on the foot of the mountain. I mean, he's up at the top. If he doesn't know, you know, how do you know? And then the Kilesas were completely subsided. That's how I trained myself. So, I mean, what is left to train you is the way I train myself. If you can't take it, if you think it's too rough, then it's up to you. It's completely up to you. I mean, you can go anytime you want. I mean, I don't keep you back. I mean, sometimes I think, you know, sometimes I do have the impression that the students think, you know, oh, you know, it is so nice, you know, we are his students, you know, he must be so grateful to have so many students or so few students. I mean, without us as students, you know, he's not a teacher. Isn't it? Of course I'm not a teacher. And I don't want to be a teacher. I never wanted to be a teacher. And especially now, after reflecting about the last 7 lives, you know, how much worth it is, how much troublesome it is. I mean, just to teach the obnoxious kilesas of the West to the utterly conceited. I mean, what kind of conceit is it? I know Dhamma better, you know, because in the books it says like this and it's like this. My Dhamma doesn't come from the books. My Dhamma comes from the practice. From fighting the kilesas from the moment I open my eyes to the moment I close my eyes. That's the Dhamma that I have. I don't have any other Dhamma. And that is pretty much in line with the Thai forest tradition. The Dhamma. I mean, that is the way the Thanachar Mahāpūrva teaches. And of course, you know, some people don't like it. There will always be people who don't like it. There were, even at the Lord Buddha's time, there were people who didn't like it, the teachings of the Lord Buddha. They just didn't agree with the teachings. So they wanted to kill the Lord Buddha. I mean, and now we think, oh, everything must be just nice and fine, you know. One doesn't have to hurt other people. Where are we now? I mean, we completely lost the relationship. We completely lost the scale. The Lord Buddha was killed for his teaching, or they were trying to kill for his teaching, or at least defame him, or whatever, you know, whatever means, you know. We do know a lot of, quite a few stories, you know, in the suttas, you know, where it is told us. They're trying to defame him, or they're trying to kill him. I mean, about Thanachar Mahāpūrva, I knew. They didn't like his teaching, or they didn't like what he said, so they hired a professional killer to kill him off. Just because of what he said. I mean, that must have provoked a lot of anger in these people. Because he said. So they brought a professional killer. I mean, this professional killer tried to from the distance with a shotgun. But it just didn't go off. So he went with a revolver to his kuti and fired, you know, from near distance, 3 or 4 meters, 6 shots. At him, at his house. But Thanachar Mahāpūrva wasn't even hurt. None of the bullets ever reappeared. They went out of the revolver and just disappeared in the air. Just disappeared. I mean, there was no sign of any bullet hitting any of the wood or any of his clothes. Right? And when a monk was running up concerned about the safety of Thanachar Mahāpūrva, I heard some shotguns, yeah? Oh, yeah? Yeah, there were some. And then he showed his answer, but you know, there's nothing happened, huh? Nothing happened. Don't worry. I mean, there will always be people who don't like what arahants will say. Arahants have to say the truth. They have to say the truth that is in line with the Dhamma. They cannot lie. They cannot fool other people. Like everybody else tries to fool people. Like a teacher tries to fool his disciples, you know, to make himself big, or to make himself famous, or to make himself wealthy. An arahant can't. I mean, he's just pure Dhamma. He has destroyed the self that wants. I mean, just imagine. Just think about it. What is going to teach you? When there is an Arahant sitting in front of you, who is teaching you? Who? If it's not pure Dhamma, what else is teaching you? He has gotten rid of his self. He has gotten rid of his pride. So who is teaching you? Think about it. Everybody think about carefully. I mean, an Arahant has no more pride. That doesn't mean that he cannot say things. The Dhamma that is victorious and glorious, that is the one that is teaching his disciples. That is the one that is teaching his lay people. But all what I get when I scold the Westerners that I come here, all that with me, or when I went to Germany, I mean, all what I get back is anger. This is outrageous. This is not in conform with the teachings of the Buddha. What do they know? What is in conform? I mean, I just teach a Dhamma that I have developed within the last 18 years. I mean, has any one of you done more? Has anyone of you gone through this practice? In the beginning I thought, you know, I'm not special, you know. When I looked at Thanachar Mahapur, I thought, oh, I mean, his practice, you know, that is really something. If I did something of his strenuous practice, you know, maybe I did 10% of it or 15% of it. But still the monks, you know, think that I'm tough. But I never believed it. Until I see you, I mean, I must have some heart within me. I must have some toughness. Otherwise I would have given in to the kleshas long, long time ago. And without heartwood, you know, you're just soft, you know, you sway in the wind of the kleshas, you know. If they blow north, you know, you go north. If they blow south, you go south. If they blow east, you go east. And if they blow west, you go west. I mean, getting back, you know, all these angry reactions, or some of these angry reactions, make me think, what the hell? Why do I put myself through trouble? I don't need to teach. I mean, people come here, you know, and ask for the guidance. I then give the guidance and they become outrageous. They become angry at me. I mean, I didn't pull them down on it without asking them. No, they ask for it, you know. I just don't understand it. I mean, I don't need to teach. I can go wherever I want. And the last few years, you know, with the exception, you know, because of metta, I took you with me. Or some of you I took with me. Out of loving kindness, out of trying to help, you know, to get a grip in your spiritual practice, I took you with me. Not me, I'm just alone and I'm happy. I'm just perfectly happy. And the less people bother me, the more happy I am. I mean, you can believe it or not. But if that is not going to stop, you know, I just will retreat somewhere. I mean, I just will hide and nobody is going to find me. I mean, Thailand is still a country where you can perfectly hide. And there are other countries, you know, besides Thailand, you know, you just disappear. I mean, I don't need to teach. I don't need to help. I mean, I help because I have metta. I really feel that you are seeking guidance. Eh? That's why I help. And the person who really seeks guidance, you know, I help. I'm always willing to help. Because I know what it is like, you know, when you seek guidance and you don't find guidance. Or you don't find true guidance. That's why I'm here. I just don't know what I'm going to do. But At the moment I'm pretty much, probably because of this reflection, I'm pretty much fed up of going to teaching or going anywhere. I mean, I just go for myself. I'm happy. I'm just happy with myself. I mean, when I went to this village, you know, just 2 days before we left, there was a funeral. And at the funeral, there were some people who, you know, they all, the Thais are all Buddhists, eh? At least in name. So some of them, you know, trying to pay respect to the Buddha, to the Dhamma and the Sangha. They invited the monks to chant, and so I took place. And some, but most of them, you know, were sitting on the hill smoking and drinking, you know, not even interested. And then, you know, I just scolded them off, you know, like hell. I really scolded. I mean, they are Buddhists. You don't even pay respect to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, to the Sangha. You know that there are five precepts, but you have no interest of taking them. You have no interest of keeping them. Do the hell you know where you're going? Don't you know that you're going straight down to hell? I mean, I was scolding them for quite a while. And the next day, I was going on Pindabad, assuming nothing. And I was completely surprised, because it was about the double of number of people who put something in my book. And the number of people, the villagers, put something in my boat was nearly double. Then they put it on normal days. And when I came back to the monastery, I was amazed because quite a few more people came to the monastery, came to bring food into the monastery, to offer it to the monks. And I just told them, maybe yesterday I was a little bit rough on you, wasn't I? And then, you know, some of them really smiled and said, yes, but you know, we need it. We really need it. We really need somebody who puts you back in the track, who puts our attention on what is true and what is wrong, what is right and what is wrong. So please stay here. Please stay with us, you know, and do it. The more often you do it, the more we appreciate it. I mean, that is just completely the opposite of the Western attitude, isn't it? Just think about it. And actually, you know, when I came here, you know, I thought, you know, I just came alone. And before I looked around myself, you know, there were two cars of the villagers who were taking me here back to Banta. I mean, about 30 people. Or 35 people, all of them wanted to send me out. I was so surprised, you know, the more you scold them, the more they love you. I mean, in the West, the more you scold them, the more they hate you. And they probably wouldn't give you any food the next day. You just scold the people, you know, who give you food every day. And the next day in the West, you know, you just don't see anybody of these lay people anymore. Probably for weeks. I mean, they're so pissed at you that you told them the truth. I mean, I'm so, living in Thailand, I'm sometimes so surprised about this religion. I mean, they're very simple-minded people. But you know, once they hear it, once they hear the Dhamma, maybe some of them get pissed, no? But the ordinary person, you know, reflects upon it. Yes, what he says is actually true. I mean, we have forgotten it because, you know, we are caught up in our life, so it is good. And that's why they always want. I mean, every village you pass by, and they don't have a monastery, you know, they invite monks, you know, to stay. Please, please, please stay here, you know, and be the field of our merit. Be. I mean, I wonder when this... If that ever comes to you, if that ever comes to the West, this kind of attitude. This kind of respect, this kind of generosity, and this kind of gratitude. If it ever, ever finds its way to the breath. So far, my two visits back to my home country really did not show any good signs. So I just wonder what is going to happen. Is the real kind of Buddhism really coming back? Is it really developing in the West? Or is just the kind of Magnibbana that is what really drives people? I want my Nibbana fast, within 2 minutes, and customer satisfaction guaranteed. That's the kind of Nibbana we want. That's the kind of spiritual enlightenment we want. That's what we read in the text. I mean, we read in the text, he enters the first jhana and enjoys the bliss. Then, you know, after a while, you know, he thinks the bliss is too exciting. He enters the second jhana and enjoys all the joy. And then after a few hours, you know, he thinks, oh, this joy is still too exciting. And then he enters the third jhana, and then he enjoys the peacefulness. And then he thinks after a few hours, he thinks, oh, this peacefulness, that is still too bothersome. And then he goes into the stillness of the fourth jhana. And after the stillness of the fourth jhana, or the calm of the fourth jhana, he reflects about his previous lives, and he understands the nature of karma, and he just gets in line. I mean, it says in some suttas, no? I mean, I just wonder, you know, why these Thai forest monks must be completely stupid. I mean, they must be complete fools. Now, to drag themselves through dangerous places, to go into cremation camps, to get caught, you know, by infectious diseases, nearly to die, or faint of pain, I mean, they must be completely fools. To get in line. I mean, they're stupid. And from the Western point of view, of course, we think that's stupid. I mean, you just go in the first, second, third, fourth jhana, you reflect about your previous lives, and then you get enlightened. That's it. Everything else we don't want. And especially we don't want anybody who shows us our greed and shows us our anger. This we don't want. We don't want to see our greed, and we want to see our anger. We just want to hide it firmly under the skin. And if somebody obnoxious like me comes, you know, and puts a finger on the wound, and the anger comes up, and then of course, it's me that who is guilty of the anger. It's not the owner of the anger who is guilty that his anger explodes. It's a person who points at the faults of the others, who shows them the anger. And the teaching of Tanaja Mahabodhi, he constantly was on now. Like one of the senior Western monks said, you know, it was always a cooking pot of anger, especially for the Western disciples. Because he was scolding them, they had to do the duties at his kuti, and then he said, this isn't right, this is not right, this is not right, where is your sati, and so on, constantly. And just imagine. It's just a pressure point. Okay. But of course, I mean, we just go to Magnibbana and just order one Nibbana. Within 2.5 minutes, we get it. It's guaranteed. If you don't get it in this time, we'll get it for free. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, reflection, end. I mean, I do want to meet a person who has gone this far. I mean, so far I've met only the people who really nearly killed themselves off in the dangers of the forest, in the dangers of the jhana. Constantly under strenuous effort. I mean, sitting through the night and breaking, and so that their skin is break. I mean, Tenachin says his skin was literally breaking and bloody, bleeding. That's how he trained himself. I mean, you know, compared to this, you know, I value his teaching, but probably people from the West don't even understand it. They don't even think why it is necessary. I mean, I can get it into my culture, you know, what is it? Internet TV or over TV, taught by over TV, you know, having my Coke, you know, standing beside me and my pizza and so on. I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, this is the wrong place. This is the Forest University. I mean, this is not Meklibana. So, and with this, I end my talk.